Finally, this hour, we remember writer Tony Hillerman. He's best known for his mysteries about the Navajo tribal police. Hillerman passed away yesterday. He was 83 years old. And as NPR's Lynn Neary reports, his novels evoked a place and a culture that had largely been ignored in mysteries.
Tony Hillerman's interest in Native Americans began in his childhood in the small town of Sacred Heart, Oklahoma, where his Catholic parents sent him to a school for Indian girls, which was run by nuns. But his fascination with the culture was renewed shortly after World War II, when he happened to see a Navajo curing ceremony for some Marines who had just returned from war. Hillerman began reading and studying about the Navajo, and many years later he drew on that experience in his first novel, The Blessing Way. When Hillerman sat down to write his first novel, as he explained in an interview on WHYY's Fresh Air, he didn't think of himself as a great writer.
I knew what I could do. I knew I could write clearly. I knew I was good at description. I knew I could move a narrative along. I didn't know if I could develop a character. I didn't know if I could plot. I simply wanted to tell a story.
He certainly had a wonderful way of developing characters and a great straightforward way of plotting a story that was incredibly entertaining.
Writer Michael McGarrity knew Hillerman for more than 40 years as both a mentor and a friend. McGarrity says Hillerman broke new ground with his 18 Navajo police mysteries.
He took the mystery genre and expanded it tenfold by bringing in the elements of the Navajo country and the Navajo people and the cultural clashes that existed between that world and the world of the white man, and also at times even between the various different elements of the Navajo communities themselves.
Hillerman created two memorable characters, Lieutenant Joe Leaphorn, older and more cynical about the ways of his people, and Jim Chi, younger and steeped in Navajo spirituality. In a PBS production based on Hillerman's novel Skinwalkers, the two men's differences are clearly drawn.
ASAP to forensics and find out where you can buy an airplane like that.
You wouldn't. It's made of bone. And if it's made by a skinwalker, I'd say that's human bone.
Skinwalker.
Yeah.
Evil shapeshifters lurking in the night, wreaking havoc on innocent people. That sound about right?
During an interview on NPR's All Things Considered, Hillerman said that in his books, he likes to drag people into the Navajo culture and let them take a look at it.
Because I think we could learn a lot from the Navajo way. They place a tremendous value on taking care of your family. Very little value, in fact, even a negative value on owning too many material possessions. Being rich is almost per se proof that you're not a good Navajo. You haven't shared.
And always, says McGarrity, Hillerman's novels were set in the Southwest he loved so much.
The weather and the landscape and the clouds and the sky and what lives on the land and what grows on the land, all of that meant something to him. I think because of that, his stories really resonated with people across the globe because he painted such vivid pictures of a place that he held very dear to his heart.
Hillerman died Sunday at a hospital in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He is survived by his wife and six children. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Here's a way that both of this year's presidential candidates stand out. John McCain and Barack Obama have both written or at least co-authored best-selling books.
And when you start reading, you get a vivid sense of the men who would be president. It's hard to write thousands of words without revealing something of yourself.
So we've been rereading those books along with Newsweek editor and author John Meacham. Over the next couple of mornings, we'll hear about a key experience of each candidate, and we begin with Barack Obama's childhood in Indonesia. Meacham says an Indonesian stepfather brought the family there amid the turmoil of the 1960s.
You did not know from day to day or week to week which side of the regime you would be on. It was a fickle regime. And that very directly affected Obama's stepfather. He and his mother had waited a good while to come to Indonesia from Hawaii. And the reason was his stepfather had gotten on the wrong side of the regime and had been sent off. Hmm. So I think it's a very tactile experience of foreign policy. And I think the takeaway is that foreign policy has real life consequences. And it's not something that is simply talked about at the Council on Foreign Relations or in the hearing rooms on Capitol Hill, Obama has been right in the thick of a messy, asymmetrical, fluid situation in a country where power moves quickly and which can be a pawn in a larger game, in this case, the Cold War.
He makes a few basic points about this complicated country. He points out that it is the world's largest Muslim country in terms of the number of Muslims who are there, that it is, in his view, a very important country, rich in natural resources, that it is nevertheless a country that most Americans could never find on a map. And yet he says it's a country where the U.S. has had enormous influence.
When you look at how he wants to govern if he were to win, he is someone who I think is more conscious of what American power feels like on the receiving end than on the giving end. Americans are accustomed to being, since, I would argue, since the summer of 1945, to being the person who sits in the control seat and decides what other people are going to do.
We are in charge of the world, or imagine that we are.
You're right. And occasionally that crashes into reality, as it did in Vietnam. But interestingly, I think that Obama has experienced the implications of America's Cold War policy in his own life in a distant land in a way that, you know, Ronald Reagan or Walter Mondale or George Herbert Walker Bush simply did not.
What insights do you think from his writings or any other sources, what insights do you think he draws from this that are relevant to some of the problems of today? How, if at all, to try to spread democracy around the world? How to deal with terrorism, other issues?
I think he understands the law of unintended consequences because if you spend part of your childhood in a country in chaos in which America has played some role in creating or trying to capitalize on that chaos, I think you have more empathy with the people whose lives we are affecting. I'm not saying that you're sympathetic to them. Let me be very clear. But I think you can imaginatively put yourself in the position of another country, of another region, and how that region or that country may respond to overtures of American power.
You hit an important distinction there between empathy and sympathy. Mm-hmm. I suppose you want someone who totally understands the other side but is still acting in American interests.
Exactly. And I think that's something that has been lost in the hurly-burly of the autumn campaign, as things tend to get lost. But I do think that's an important distinction because empathy suggests that you will be able to think a couple of moves ahead of what the implications of an expression of American power would be. And so I think the direct lesson of what Obama's written about both in Dreams from My Father and The Audacity of Hope is that what we do is often uncontrollable. When you unleash forces abroad, it's very, very hard to manage them.
He writes about Franklin Roosevelt's famous four freedoms that Roosevelt considered important: freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from want, freedom from fear. Obama seems to suggest that while they're all important, that freedom from want and freedom from fear are the things that have to come first.
Yes. If you are hungry, you're not that interested in freedom of the press. If you are impoverished, you are interested in keeping yourself warm against the cold. And it's harder to think in Jeffersonian rights of man terms. Once those first two freedoms are secured, the others tend to follow. It's a very conservative argument that without order, nothing else is possible. That idea has not appeared to be part of the strategic approach to our desire to transform parts of the world that have wished us active harm.
It's interesting the different directions you can take that line of thinking, though. You can say, well, I'm not going to be an idealist and demand that everyone have a democratic election, which sounds nice and realistic. But it can also be, I'm not going to be an idealist and I'm going to embrace whatever dictator brings stability as long as they're relatively friendly to us. You can go to places that people would find dismaying in different ways or delightful in different ways.
Yes, and I would say welcome to a fallen world and diplomacy in a world that is destined to some extent to disappoint us. This is something that interests me about both Obama and McCain, is they are both essentially tragic figures. They understand that the world does not conform to our wishes. The fact that Obama's religious views are as informed by Abraham Lincoln and Reinhold Niebuhr as they are the Gospels to some extent. I think that comes from having grown up and seen firsthand that the world's more complicated than it seems in headlines. It's a messy, unfinished world out there, and America can be a force for good. But as he's quoted before, we always want to make sure we're constantly checking ourselves, as Lincoln would have it. We know that God isn't on our side, but to try to make sure we're on God's side.
John Meacham is editor of Newsweek, and he's been reading books by Barack Obama. You heard him mention Reinhold Niebuhr, a theologian who struggled with how we should involve ourselves in a world full of evil. That same American thinker figures in books co-authored by John McCain. And we'll hear more about that tomorrow as we continue our discussions about the candidates' books with John Meacham, whose own books include American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House.
This week on NPR's podcast, Book Tour, we're proud to present a special four-part reading of Toni Morrison's new novel. A Mercy is set when America was still a collection of colonies.
1682, and Virginia was still a mess. Who could keep up with the pitched battles for God, King, and land?
Toni Morrison takes us through it with questions and answers from NPR Books correspondent Lynn Neary. Join us at npr.org/booktour.
Just as the presidential candidates reduce their messages to simple sound bites, we've been going the other way.
John McCain and Barack Obama have done the opposite of sound bite. They've written or co-authored multiple books.
McCain's books, co-authored with Mark Salter, often focus on one searing experience. And John Meacham, editor of Newsweek, has been reading those passages on McCain.
Well, he was shot down 41 years ago this week. He was a grandson of an admiral. The son of an admiral comes from a long line of warriors. The family traces its warrior line actually back to Charlemagne. There's been a McCain in each of America's wars since the Revolution.
John McCain was captured by the North Vietnamese when his plane was shot down in 1967. They tortured him and held him more than 5 years. During the same period, a young Barack Obama was living in Indonesia, and yesterday we discussed he's writing on that experience. John McCain's time as a prisoner of war in Southeast Asia is also seen as a key to his character.
He is absolutely resolute. In crisis, under fire, his instinct is to endure, not to compromise. Remember, he has a very sophisticated view of the Vietnam War. When he came back, he asked to go to the war college so he could basically catch up and figure out what had happened.
He'd missed the whole war, basically,
yeah.
A lot of it.
5 years, he'd only been told what the communists wanted to tell him. And it's interesting, his father, too, just as a sort of a tragic side note, had to authorize bombings of Hanoi that could have killed his son. So this is a family that understands the price of war. And John McCain is not eager to use force. I think that's wrong. He's someone whose life experience is, if you are going to commit American troops to a conflict, then you damn well better be prepared to do what you have to do to win.
The lesson that he took from that was not bad war, bad idea, bad choice, but we could have executed it better.
Precisely. He also has, when he went into politics in the 1980s, he has a slightly more complicated record on questions of projections of power. He was against putting the Marines in Lebanon in 1983.
Let's add another nuance here, though, because as you read through the multiple books that John McCain has written with Mark Salter, you come across in a book called Hard Call, a chapter that is admiring of the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. Even though Niebuhr was somebody who opposed the war in Vietnam. As McCain summarizes it here, he believed that in Vietnam we'd fallen into the trap of deluding ourselves that we were invariably a force for goodness in the world. How did McCain come to be an admirer of someone who was such an opponent of it?
Because McCain is a moral realist, which is, I think, a Niebuhrian construct. Niebuhr is the great Protestant theologian who had a hugely tragic view of the world, that the world would never fully conform to our wishes. We can never make it be exactly what we want it to be. And Niebuhr, as a Christian, found the essence of the gospel message to be tragic.
I wonder if you look at this theologian who argued that you have to get in and get your hands dirty, basically, in real life, if you have a key to the way this particular Senator John McCain has thought. If you think about the legislator who's gone in and compromised with people and tried to get the best bill that he can, or the senator who supported the Iraq War, even though he seems over the years to have had grave doubts about the way it's being waged, or even the senator who last summer looked at this conflict between Russia and Georgia that most of us were bewildered by, and he chose a side and said, these guys are right, these guys are wrong, and let's support them.
He clearly understands the art of compromise. He has passed significant legislation. He has made mistakes, the Keating Five, you know, the scandal where he was seen as being too close to a savings and loan, was looking for government favors. McCain didn't grant them, but he was part of a ethics investigation that shamed him, I think, is a safe way of putting it. And instead of shutting down or mindlessly defending himself, he threw himself into campaign finance reform. He tried to learn from it and then do better. I think that's a classic kind of Niebuhrian thing to do. You do the best you can with what you have. And I think if people are looking for some grand McCain doctrine of foreign policy, I think you probably look in vain. I think he is ultimately a big-hearted man who believes in he has a far more romantic view of America's role in the world than Senator Obama does. I think that clearly comes out of the books. And
what do you mean romantic?
I think he has a more epic sense that America can be the America of 1945. I sometimes have to really make an effort to remind myself that John McCain fought in Vietnam and not the Second World War. And I'm not being cute about his age. He just feels like a figure from that war as opposed to Vietnam.
What does it mean that we've had these discussions about these two very different men, Barack Obama and John McCain, and both times we've wandered around to the subject of Reinhold Niebuhr, the same theologian, with this very complicated view of the world, this effort to see the world in nuance but still make a moral choice about it. Does that suggest that they are alike in their thinking in ways that neither of them would want to admit a couple of days before the election?
Absolutely. I think they're much more similar than dissimilar. I think they both have tragic sensibilities. They both like For Whom the Bell Tolls, Hemingway's novel about the Spanish Civil War, which, as you remember, Robert Jordan, the hero of the novel, he joins the forces fighting the fascists in Spain. And the novel ends with, in the popular memory of the novel, Jordan dying. Jordan doesn't die at the end of the novel. It's interesting. He's lying on the forest floor.
He's been left for dead. He's left himself for dead.
But he doesn't die. The image Hemingway leaves us with is the heart pounding on the forest floor as he is taking aim at an enemy of freedom. And then the novel ends. I think the fact that both men, both Obama and McCain, have talked about the importance of that novel suggests that they have a very similar worldview in that they believe in doing their duty as best they can. They believe in trying to do the right as best they can determine what that is. And I think there's a sincerity and a conviction in both men. And I think that if anything, given the incredible distinction between their ages, their life experience, you can go down the list, but at heart, they both see the world essentially the same way. It is tragic. It is destined to disappoint us. But we have to do the best we can to ameliorate that disappointment.
John Meacham of Newsweek magazine and also author of American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House. Thanks for reading these selections with us and talking about them.
Thanks so much.
Andrew Davidson's new novel isn't quite as intricate as that movie, but it's pretty close. It's called The Gargoyle, and it tells a disturbing love story that spans centuries and continents. Rick Kleffel of member station KUSP in Central California has the story.
The unlikable, unnamed narrator of Andrew Davidson's first novel, The Gargoyle, crashes his car while driving under the influence of drugs and alcohol. Trapped in the fiery wreck, he suffers third and fourth degree burns over most of his body.
What an unexpected reversal of fate. Only after my skin was burned away did I finally become able to feel.
In this reading from the novel, the narrator experiences his skin after more than a year in a specialized pressure garment.
Only after I was born into physical repulsiveness did I come to glimpse the possibilities of the heart. I accepted this atrocious face and abominable body because they were forcing me to overcome the limitations of who I am, while my previous body allowed me to hide them.
While recovering in a hospital, he meets Marianne Engel. She's a sculptor of grotesque gargoyles who tells him stories of past lives in which she claims they were lovers. The settings of her tales range from 9th century Iceland to 13th century Germany and beyond. Andrew Davidson had dreamed of her, a woman with wild hair and eyes to match, and began writing the novel when a particularly vivid vision ensured he could no longer ignore her.
She's in front of a church saying things that were a little bit crazy or sounded crazy, but I knew they weren't. This character came to me and said, "Okay, here I am and you're going to listen to me." She wasn't going to leave me alone if I didn't.
As he worked on The Gargoyle, he wrote for websites and taught English in Japan. He was also teaching himself by imitating great writers from all disciplines.
Poetry was all about the word and the beauty of the line and the preciseness of the language. Stage plays, it's all about dialogue. Screenplays are all about the visuals.
Davidson says that the most enjoyable part of his work is the research.
For me, it's discovering that what I need to understand is how homes were built in 9th century Iceland. It's discovering that what I really need to find out about is the treatment of severe burns.
He pursued wildly divergent avenues of research without worrying how they'd fit into his fiction, and some did not. But he knew he would include a simple, beguiling idea for an inverted love story.
Everybody's had this feeling of being burned at the end of a relationship, and I had been wondering for a long time, well, how could I write a story that starts with a burn? So it was a number of things coming together. This interest in burn treatment, it was this story idea that I've been carrying around for a long time, and the character of Marianne Engel.
As Marianne Engel and the burned narrator are learning about each other's lives, past and present, Davidson draws the reader into their unorthodox platonic romance.
One of the questions that I always ask myself when developing characters is, who do they love and why do they love this person and what happened in that relationship? Because this gives you a real sense of who somebody is. I mean, if you know who somebody loves, you know who that person is.
Andrew Davidson says he set out to write a love story. But the gargoyle that emerged from the flames of the car crash combines a disturbing imagination with a passion for research. For NPR News, I'm Rick Kleffel.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.